Access number 29065, Mr. Michael White, Real 8. Now, what were your first impressions when you got to Pusan, your first sight of Pusan in Korea?
Well, as I stated, kind of like the ship, it was actually stopped outside the what I call the harbour of Pusan, and it was started to drizzle. And as I'd actually had to get up that evening or early hours, I think it was about 3 or 4 in the morning, to go to the loo, I decided to go up on the deck and do it over the side. And when I actually got up there, it was just about getting kind of dark sort of thing, and my first sight into Korea made my heart go pitter-patter, because there was two of these beautiful hospital ships. I'd never seen one before, and it's they're all these white ships, and they got this red line goes along and these big red crosses on. And I stood on that deck, I think I was on my own, and I thought, what the hell am I doing here, sort of thing. And anyway, it was just after that that it started getting lighter and things like that, you know, more people started coming on the deck sort of thing. And I remember where this kind of this so-called gung-ho system from a lot of the people and things like that, these soldiers, it was more subdued then, and they're thinking, you know, what the hell are we going into now? And it was not until later when the ship was then allowed to go actually into the docks, and we actually docked right in.
Was there any sort of reception for you?
We was a long time really getting off, but whilst we were there, there was the American band turned up. I think they're all coloured soldiers sort of thing, and I suppose there was more of a show band, and so they all used to wear these chrome helmets. And they used to have lots and lots of braid on there, and their boots, they used to have all this fancy lacing, is what I remember. And they had all this wonderful, weird and wonderful set of instruments with these big umpire type things. And what they did, they then gave us a demonstration of American military marching. They was marching up and down, and they played up all these jazzed up tunes sort of thing, like the St. Louis Blues. And of course, all the British soldiers then, they're all on the side of the ship overlooking, and they was all giving cheers. And that, because I suppose most of us, we never seen America. All we've been used to, kind of, if you saw a band, was kind of like the British military style marches and that. Here we got this American band giving this display with up and down with all this jazzed up music.
And what happened then when you got ashore?
It was a long time for us kind of disembarking, because I suppose different units were going first, and whether we were one of the latter ones to go. And then when we actually disembarked, we had this small little tiny stroll, I suppose you call it stroll, up to the railway station, or the entrance of the railway station.
Any particular impressions of Pusan itself?
Well, what I actually remember, it seemed like a shanty town, as I remember. And of course, there was this funny smell there, sort of thing, which we never encountered before. And I suppose it was all to do with the toiletries and things like that, you know, kind of all this night soil as they used to collect for, you know, to put in onto the land and that. But I haven't really got any great memories as such.
So what about the train journey?
What I remember when we actually got off, whilst we was actually waiting to go on the train, there was this contingent of gentlemen. There was, I think, all gentlemen as such, and they had this. They had these uniformed people, and they were kind of issuing us with kind of like American coffee and American donuts, which was kind of something new to us. Kind of, you know, kind of soldiers who had come from British rationing as such. And then there was another contingent, and they had kind of uniforms on, similar to like the Salvation Army, but they were not the Salvation Army. And they offered to each of the soldiers a little tiny brown prayer book, and I think it was like one of the things like from the New Testament, like the Matthew, Mark, Luke and John. And I still got mine after all this time. But as I stated before, many of the soldiers within our troop, they were the old soldiers as such, like the womanizers and the hardened drinkers. And of course, they got this book. But normally, where perhaps in Hong Kong, you could imagine a lot of them throwing these things away and that. But I can't remember seeing any of them actually throw them away, because I suppose now we were going into the unknown, and it was perhaps, hopefully, it was an insurance policy.
Now, what about the train?
Now, when we boarded the train, it was like one of these old, reminds me of one of these old American trains, like the films used to see, the cowboy films of Jesse James used to hold up. And like the train itself, it was all wooden seats. We were lucky, really, because our carriage, we had all our seats had glass in, where lots of the other carriages perhaps had nothing in, whether they'd been broken or what have you. And so we were kind of guided into these different kind of carriages, and we sat, it was to either side, there were wooden seats, and so what we did, we put all our kit bags underneath the actual seatings, and all our big long kit bags, it was all piled up down the gangway, they all piled on top of each other and things like that. And this is basically when we actually kind of set off. And always remember all these poor old refugees as such, especially the poor little children, they were all kind of dressed in kind of like army uniforms of assortments, either British, Americans or anything. And they used to have, some of them used to have these huge big American boots which had their kind of gaiters attached and all the laces done, and they looked so pathetic, and they looked up there and their hands were held out kind of asking for any kind of form of food or even anything as such. And
were
so
you, did you give them anything?
And so afterwards, when we they issued us, each individual kind of on the train, they issued with a cardboard box with all these assorted tins of goodies, like tins of beans with pork, and there was spaghettis and all these other bits and pieces. There was tins with chocolate in, and there were cigarettes in, and toilet papers and all that. This was the American C7 rations. And so really it was like it was a luxury to us to have all these things. But anyway, we kind of, like lots of the people, they offered it to the civilians and things like that. And then the train set off, and then there was this long journey zigzagging through the, you saw these paddy fields, and there's all the hills and bits and pieces, and it used to stop every so often for no unknown reason and things like that. Then it would set off again, and it went through the day and then through the night, and I think it was about 16 hours before we came to our final stop. And
you saw a lot of wrecked trains.
Yes, going up, you see, I went to Korea, what we call the centre part of the war. The war lasted 3 years. The first year was very mobile, when it went from the centre part of Korea down to the, more or less down to the Pusan perimeter, then it went right up to the more or less the Yellow River, kind of like the Chinese border. Then it got pushed back again to more or less the halfway line. Now, I went kind of in the second year, when the war was not slowing down. They'd actually kind of decided to have these lines where they decided to stop and fight, and so that I've lost my chain of thought.
We're just talking about all these wrecked trains.
Yeah, so on route, kind of the war, where it had been much more mobile than it was now, there'd been trains going forward and backwards. And of course, with the Americans, especially American aircraft, they used to shoot up all these planes and all things like that. And so on the side of the track, there'd be all these wrecked carriages with all and things like that, with all these bullet holes all in them and things like that. And also, before we actually got on the train, whilst we were actually on the station platform, some of us had rifles, some had Sten guns and other kind of different weapons, and those were rifles. We were issued with a bandolier of 50 rounds. Now, I'd never seen one of these before. This is kind of like a cotton thing with they're all in fives, and it goes round your shoulder, and it's so we was all ordered to load our rifles with ammunition and put the safety catch on. And those with Stens were issued with boxes of 9mm bullets. And then kind of like we was then ordered to put like our safety catches on, because we were told that sometimes these trains were kind of ambushed by guerrillas, because there were still a lot of these so-called either North Korean or even Korean civilians who were kind of like they were ambushing things behind the lines as such. So we set off, and it was like 16 hours later when we came to their final stop.
Now, where was that?
Well, as we were there, at that time, we got no idea where we were, but I understand it was some sort of a Tok Chon junction or something like that. It'd been a station. I'm not certain what it was. But we were then, we was then dispersed and that, and we were then picked up by these Americans. There was all these black American Negroes, and they had these American three-tonners, or two-and-a-half-tonners, as they call them in America, and they were called the 49ers, and they had these kind of these signs gaily painted actually on their doors of their trucks and things like that. So we all boarded these American trucks, and they took us to a camp called Britannia Camp, which is, I understand, is kind of like a little bit of a transit camp behind the line where people go back for kind of when they're on reserve and places like that. Now, when we got there, I think we...
Now, this is November by then.
I think it was either the end of October or early November, because I've still got the dates actually in a diary, so I know the exact dates. But when we got to Britannia Camp, it started raining as such, and we was looking about us anxiously what everything was, because everything was new to us. Now, there are all these American-type ridge tents, and then all these tents all had duck boards in them, which is kind of these wooden platforms, and then also they also had these American camp beds, which are these kind of like these folding beds with made of canvas. And then kind of we was, because it was getting, I think it was getting dark by then, what I remember, we then had to go to the what we call the so-called cookhouse, and we had mess tin. We were using mess tin, our own mess tins, for, I think, more or less perhaps one of the first time. And so we went there with our two mess tins handed out, and then they had all these big dishes, and they had these huge pieces of steak, and also these great big half pieces of chicken. Now, we'd never seen anything like this before, and like I say, we had those. I mean, a big piece of steak or a big half piece of chicken wouldn't more or less fill the mess tin with all these other bits and pieces, and kind of with the other mess tin, there was all this American type sweet went in there, and I can't remember what we did about it, because I think we had a tin mug for our tea or coffee in there. Those times you had the choice. And so we went back, and it seemed marvellous to us, because it was just like Christmas, and you know, because there was still rationing in England and things like that. So we was then at Britannia Camp, what I remember, about a couple of days.
Now, you mentioned burning oil drums.
Yeah.
So tell us about that.
Because in Korea, we'd actually come from a so-called warm Hong Kong, and Korea was now coming what I'd call their real autumn time. And, of course, it was getting cold at night, although it was raining when we first got there. But I remember the next day it was kind of cold, and I think the rain had stopped. But everyone... we was just waiting. We didn't know what we was waiting for, but people were standing around and trying to keep warm, and so they used to have these 40-gallon oil drums, and of course, kind of, I suppose the old soldiers knew what to do, and so they used to put this kind of certain amount of earth actually into the oil drum, and they used to get this, because they were unlimited petrol everywhere, you used to pour this petrol in these oil drums, and then they'd throw a match in, and then there'd be this great big woof went up to like that, and of course people's kind of hair got singed and eyebrows and what have you. But then all this black smoke used to go up, and people used to stand around semi in this smoke trying to keep warm. But it was whilst actually in the actual the camp itself, this is where we got issued with winter clothing, because the first year actually in Korea, the British soldiers, they just had the more normal battle dress, and then kind of they had to either beg, borrow, or steal from the Americans all kind of this other equipment, you know, for the winter period. But we was now coming up to the second winter, so the British decided to kind of re-equip, you know, the soldiers. So this is what we then had, our new equipment, and more or less starting from the actual underneath, they issued us with a string vest, which I'd never had before. Then we had our normal PT vest, which we had from a normal army equipment. Then we had our normal army pullover, which is kind of like a pullover, a thin pullover, sort of a V-neck pullover. Then over the top of that, they issued us with this beautiful big thick pullover, which had a string around the neck, as I remember, a brown one that was. And then over the top of that, they issued us with kind of what I'd call like an anorak top. This was a green one. And then we also was issued with a camouflage thing, which the, like the airborne soldiers have and things like that, where you pulled up with a cord. And over the top of that, they issued this big, what we called a parka, which is a big anorak, and it used to have this big hood, used to go over the top of your head, and then inside the hood itself, it used to have a wire. So the theory being, in the winter time, you could actually push this wire right down to a slit and that. And then now with the trousers, we had, or starting from the bottom, we had these special oversized boots, and which we had these rubber soles, because normal army boots, they're kind of leather soles with big studs in them. But these army boots then, it was a similar upper, but it was more or less a rubberized one. And underneath we had this kind of this what I call, seemed to like Wellingtons, and this sole was actually got screws in it. It was actually screwed to the actual boot itself. Now inside, they issued it was kind of what we called an inner sole, and it was kind of like a mesh type sole of about it must have been at least over a quarter of an inch thick, and that went to under that. And so the idea then was if your feet sweated or anything like that, any form of sweat would filter through the inner sole and it'd stop your feet freezing and getting frostbite. Now on our feet then, we then had our normal army socks, with grey army socks, which are kind of reasonably thick. And then I remember having another big thick pair of socks issued and things like that. And then with our actual trousers, we had the normal green trouser, which matched our anorak thing, which were kind of like a nylon-y type trouser, which I suppose theoretically, other than keeping the cold, the wind out, would also help with the rain. And that, and then we also had a camouflage pair of trousers, which I suppose is similar, perhaps like the airborne had. I'd never seen them before, and it used to have like a cord round the waist. And so basically that was it. Now we also issued with some what we call ski gloves, which I thought was a bit ridiculous really. These were kind of like long white gloves, and I think it had two compartments. I suppose perhaps your thumb went into the first one and the other fingers went in the other, and they were joined together with a cord which theoretically you could put round your neck. Now that was our winter equipment. So when we finally had our movement to go to the front line.
Now, before you do that, there was evidence of the fighting. That's why I was thinking it was November, because you were only there 2 days, this incident is around the 4th to 6th of November.
Yeah,
Now, what happened? What could you hear?
Well,
I don't mean what you know happened later, but what could you tell happened there?
Now, because being in this camp, we received no instruction, we got no idea where we were, we got no idea what was happening and things like that, or where we were going. But at night time, sort of thing, I remember kind of like it was, although it rained the first day when we got there and it started getting colder, and in the night time, all you could actually see was all this sort of flashings in the sky, but there was no sound. So we was behind the line, a number of miles behind the line, where you couldn't hear the sound. And to me, it was just like the flashing of a thunderstorm, but with no thunder.
Now, what happened next, then?
Well, then we more or less we more or less had our orders to move. We didn't know where we were going, but you see, with our equipment, we had such a lot of equipment. With all this new equipment we had, so we had two pouches. We had a water bottle. We had a small pack on the side. We had a big pack on the back. And then we had a kit bag with all our clothing in, and then we had our so-called sea kit bag, which is about three-quarter size, where we had any blankets in, because we'd also been issued with two white sleeping bags, the idea going one inside the other. They were not waterproof as such, and it seemed crazy to me at that time, in those terrible conditions, why issue white sleeping bags? Why not kind of green or brown or things like that? But anyway, so when we was actually ready to move, this is all the equipment that we had. And so the whole lot actually went actually into these, I think the Canadians took us up. We had some Canadians with these American-style 2.5-tonners. So we went there. But the marvellous thing about these trucks, really, because they've all got these a proper suspension sort of thing. So there was no road, proper roads as such, actually, in Korea at that time. It was all potholes. It was all, it was either dusty in the summertime, it was muddy in the wintertime, and so it was potholes and it was bump, 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 where the British Bedford three tonners, which I learnt to drive, and I mean, they would just go up and bounce up and down the different potholes. So we then went in these Bedford, Canadian trucks, and we started moving up to the front line. And as we kind of got nearer and nearer, you could start seeing these emplacements with kind of with the red crosses in and things like that. And then as we got further and further, we suddenly came across the 25 pounders of the Kiwis, the New Zealand, the 16th Field New Zealand Field Regiment, which were 25 pounders. Their 25 pounders, they did not have these silver, what I call flash eliminators at the end. Theirs was just a straight barrel, where the British ones had these silver block flash eliminators or whatever they're called at the end. Anyway, so when we got near the 25 pounders, we knew we was getting nearer, because they always say the gunners are kind of miles beyond the line. And but as we moved then, there was you could see these medical pieces. They're all kind of beginning to get sandbag emplacements around them. And then kind of we was moving forward again, and I was amazed, really, because there was no sound of warfare. I was expecting to be everything banging and crashing and things like that, you know, kind of from the films, you know, the Hollywood war films. But it was reasonably quiet. There may have been the odd bump and things like that. And then as we started moving forward, we started coming across a lot of infantry people. And, of course, there was lots of sandbag emplacements and things like that. And then still moving forward even more, we suddenly went through a barrier of this barbed wire barrier, and that, and then suddenly the vehicles came to the stop, and there was these mortars there, and we knew we'd actually arrived. And of course the orders were to get out, and we put all our equipment in a huge great big pile. And then what I remember then, when the lads got off the trucks, you could actually see them. They were kind of walking around a little bit hunchback, you know, expecting, didn't know whether any incoming things coming and things like that. But amazingly, it was quiet.
And you weren't travelling with your mortars. You were taking over the mortars of the previous. Now, these are the mortars of what? Sea Troop 11?
These were Sea Troop of 11 Sphinx.
Battery.
Yeah. What had happened previously, the first contingent went out with the gunners. There was the 45th Field Regiment, which were 25 pounders, and then there was an independent mortar battery called the 170 battery, and then there was a battery of Bofors called 11 Sphinx. Now, as the war progressed, sort of thing, as of course we lost one troop of mortars when the Gloucesters got captured and the gunners got captured, that they, because there was not a lot of aerial warfare from the Chinese or the North Koreans and things like that, so you did not need a lot of Bofors for annual. So the idea, they moved the Bofors down to the rivers where they had the bridges, the pontoon bridges going over to kind of to look after those. And so they transferred, similar to what we did in Hong Kong, they transferred much of the battery over to 4.2 mortars. And so they had to split the mortars up. So instead of having four mortars, most of them, they'd got three mortar positions. You know, each troop had three mortars. So when we actually went through this barrier of this barbed wire barrier, and we all alighted, sort of thing, and the kit bags were all put out, all these scruffy little gunners started coming out of these holes. Now, most of these of the 11 Sphinx, they were there are the regular soldiers or ex reservists, and so there were very few kind of national service, I don't think. And most of them, they all seem so scruffy. Some had got blue berets on with no badges, and some hadn't got hats at all and things like that. They never had this equipment. We had this huge pile of equipment, and all they seemed to have got was just like a small kit bag, perhaps some salt or towel and some soap and bits and pieces, and perhaps their supply of cigarettes, because there were lots of cigarettes everywhere. And so when they all kind of came out, and I had to go and the gunner sergeants and in charge of each gun had to go and sign for the gun and the equipment. I was a chief tar at that time. I had to go to the command post, or what part of the or where the command post was. I had to go and sign for this, the artillery board, the director which put the guns on the line, and there was a huge great big tin box of maps and another big box full of first aid equipment and things like that. Now, I was only a lowly gunner national serviceman, and I was reluctant to sign for all this because the theory was that if you actually lost it, you had to pay for it. But, I mean, that was another thing. So what happened then, after it actually signed, it was only a short period afterwards, all these scruffy little gunners, they got on the trucks that we got off, and they always remember, they all shouted about kind of wait until tonight, till 4 o'clock tonight sort of thing, when it all happens, and then within seconds
hang on, a couple of things, firstly, what happened to your excess kit? Because you see, they seem to have had not much kit, and you had a lot of kit.
Yeah, well, as I stated and kind of say, they all got on these trucks, and they told us about to happen, and then there was all off, and it left us with this huge, great big pile of kit sort of thing. So what happened then? We was a party of about 30-odd gunners, 30-odd troops, 30-plus. So we were then kind of diverted to these holes in the ground where these people had been living, sleeping or what have you. And so I was actually diverted to this hole with about, I think about three other signalers or something like that, all part of our command post. And it was a hole of about, because we was on a hillside, it would be about, about 4 or 5 feet high at the back, and maybe about a couple of feet at the front, and then it was built up with sandbags. And over top was an old, what we thought, a tarpaulin. There was a big hole in the top, and it had this sign, or I thought it was in chalk or something similar to that, when it kind of happened. And so then after kind of people had kind of been guided to their different holes and perhaps where the mortars were and things like that. Afterwards, we were then kind of called, we had a new company, or a new troop commander, and he was from Leftover. And so he was taking command of us. And so he called us all together, about 30 of us, kind of like a group of us. And he more or less kind of briefly told us what's likely kind of to happen, and he said this is the last time we shall ever form together as a group, because if the shells come over, he said, we could all be killed in one go sort of thing, things like that. But he was an experienced officer, he was a captain, and he was I think he was of the World War II era, because he had he got a battle dress on or something, and he got about two rows or two and a half rows of ribbons, and over the top, which impressed me, he had the kind of the glider pilot or the wings above sort of thing. I think he'd been in the airborne landings of World War II, perhaps at the Rhine or Arnhem or things like that. And so basically then we'd divert and things like that. And then, of course, it was very noticeable at that time, because, I mean, we didn't really know where we were or whatever. We was at the foot of a hill. I think it was Hill 187. And I think at that time, the King's Own Scottish Borderers had just about left sort of thing, and the Royal Canadian Regiment had taken over. It was a complete changeover on the front.
Now, where was Hill 187? What was that area known as? Did it have a name? Well, Wansang area or something?
Well, we was kind of... We were at that time, we were still part of, we were not part of the Commonwealth Division, I don't think, at
no,
that time.
I don't mean the unit, I mean the area.
Well, the area, where the as I remember, the 38th parallel, the actual line was kind of, it was zigzagging all over the place.
So and the area didn't have a name, like Kwangsang or something?
No, I think there was some sort of line, kind of Kansas line or a line similar to like that. But at that time, we just didn't know.
Hill 187, that's all you know.
Hill 187, where it's in metres. It's like a spot height on, say, like on a map sort of thing.